Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl.
Nau mai, haere mai, kia ora. Welcome to Books and Beyond, to our Literary Lounge episode with Alison and Inika. Kia ora, Inika.
Kia ora, Alison.
Good to have you back in the studio this week.
Nice to be back.
It's a chilly day, isn't it?
It's really cold.
It's beautiful, though.
Yeah.
Now, look, on today's show, we're going to be talking about what we've been reading and what's on our to-be-read list.
Sounds good.
So I'd like to jump in, if I may, because I've been telling you about this book. It is amazing. I've just finished a book by Kelly Jo Ford, and it's called Crooked Hallelujah. Now, it's an own voice debut novel that spans four generations of Cherokee women in Oklahoma and Texas during that oil boom and bust during the 1970s and 1980s. Oh, it's just, I'm really blown away by this book. So it begins in 1974, and it starts in the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, which I know we've talked about before on this show.
Yeah.
And our main character, Justine, is a 15-year-old, and she's basically trying to just be a teenager, as you do, you know, when you're 15. So, but life is not easy. Talked about four generations of women. So we don't learn much about Granny, who's the great-grandmother.
Oh,
but
yes.
She is. We do know that she's beloved. They adore her. So then her daughter, Lula, is the matriarch of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And then Justine is her daughter. So Justine is the teenager that's trying to just get on with being a teenager.
Okay.
And then her daughter is Rainey. And what was that? I just completely forgot what I was going to say. It'll come back to me. I had some sort of insight. Oh, that's right. The reason why we've got four generations of women, and they're all living in the same house to start with, we've got one of those situations where children have children.
Basically. Yes.
So they're very young mums. The book goes into more detail and gives you context around this.
Oh, yes.
So times were difficult in Texas and Oklahoma in these days, but even more so if you were Native American and a woman as well. So you've got this sort of arid backdrop of the dry fields, and as we talked about before in another show, that the land that the Cherokee people were moved to was terrible land.
That's
really
right.
It was very arid. You couldn't really grow anything. You were lucky if you could raise a few ponies, basically. But everything was hard. So we've got this harsh backdrop, but to complicate matters is Lula's adherence to a really strict fundamentalist religion.
Oh, I see.
And this religion and all the beliefs, they're having to wear long dresses and, you know, don't show any skin, all this sort of thing, it pushes Justine really hard in the direction of bad choices.
I see.
As a way to rebel. But you've got this sort of imposing holiness Christian church that's in the background all the time. So what we've got here, it's grim, but there's something amazing and beautiful about the story. So it's intergenerational. We've got mothers and daughters struggling basically to keep the families together. So we've got poverty, there's illness, and terrible natural disasters. There'd be times when a giant dust storm would appear and farmers or ranchers would get blown away and they'd never be found, you know.
Oh, and gosh.
just
so
a
everything
hard,
against them.
Yeah, everything against them. And yet the population largely accepts this because, I guess, what are they going to do about it, basically? It's really about how powerless the Cherokee people have become, and we probably know all the reasons why, you know. So anyway, you so Justine, Lula's daughter, becomes pregnant at 15. So the novel primarily shifts between the perspective of Justine, the young mum, and her amazing daughter, Rainey, who is torn between her loyalty to her family and her aspirations to attend college and create, you know, a life of her own. Because Rainey's quite gifted, and partially because she spends so much time with her grandmother and her beloved granny too, and so she's learning from these strong women.
All the time.
Yeah. And there's a couple of books in the house, and Rainey manages to take every opportunity that she can find. But I think it's because she's surrounded by love. Now, Rainey, life isn't easy for her, even though she's very intelligent. She ends up working at a Dairy Queen, which is kind of like a fast food chain.
Yeah.
And it looks as though history's going to repeat itself, because she ends up married to a guy who's just hopeless, really. He's a drinker, and he gets violent.
I see.
Life gets really, really hard. But Rainey loves animals so much, and she has a mule that she's kind of adopted from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's when this kind of terrible husband, this guy she's with, does something terrible to the mule through neglect, that Rainey packs up and just says, I'm out of here.
It's often the way, isn't it? You know, the link between animals and, you know, domestic abuse. And, you know, it's quite a complex little relationship, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Mm. And sometimes it can be the impetus for one or other party to say, that's it.
Yeah.
You've crossed a line.
That's true.
Yeah. It's very, very powerful. So, yeah, and but not all the men, not all, in fact, men are losers or awful in the book. Justine's supervisor at the Dairy Queen is a really good man. I've just forgotten his name, but he's really awkward and everything. But he envisages a better life for Justine, so he tries to help her, and he says, "Look, I'll pay for your college, or you know, we've got to get you out of here." And you know, so there are good men. It's not all one-sided or anything like that.
Yeah,
but I think it's probably quite real. Now the so that's kind of the story, but the writing is so beautiful, and even just the way she organises the chapters. They're beautifully titled, so you don't get chapter 1, 2, 3 or anything. She gives the sections names, like Somewhere Listening for My Name, and then another section's called What Good Is an Ark to a Fish? And it kind of gives you an idea of the evolution of the characters from the 1970s up until probably what's just about the present day.
Yeah.
Now, the only real criticism I've read of the book is that it's got some really dramatic subplots in it within the lives of minor characters, but the critics feel as though these subplots never really resolve, and that they are ultimately unsatisfying chapters. But in one of it was a very dramatic subplot. They have a young neighbour on the in the Cherokee Nation, and he has adopted lesbian mums, and he has to defend them from a home invasion.
Oh.
So there was criticism.
It's a story in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. And the critics said What did that have to do with the other story arc?
Right.
I don't know. But
sometimes
yes,
happens with debut novels. The novelists, though, they want to get a lot into their first book.
Yeah. In some ways, it made me think, God, I wonder what she's going to write next.
Yeah.
But look, it is just a beautiful, beautiful book. It's one that has stayed with me. I've probably finished reading it a week ago, but I've thought about it first thing in the morning when I get up and last thing at night. It's one of those ones that has stayed my soul.
Yeah, while you read other ones, and that's always such a great marker for a...
Yes.
Longevity and a great book, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, I would just highly, highly recommend it. It's beautiful sort of things like the young woman Rainey sums up her family and the dynamic just in a couple of sentences. She says, "My father wasn't a wound or even a scar, not a black hole or a dry desert. He just wasn't. Well, not for me anyway. Mum was my sun and my moon. I was her all too, and that was us." You know, and so just lovely. Beautiful, and that tells you a lot just in a couple of sentences, doesn't it? It's, yeah, I could probably talk more about it, but it's just so beautiful.
I highly
recommend it.
That sounds beautiful. Yeah. That area and that time is so interesting, isn't it? That book by Elizabeth Wetmore that I read earlier last year, Valentine, was also set in Texas in the 1970s in an oil town.
Yes.
But this one is obviously showing from the Native American perspective.
Yeah,
interesting.
And it reminded me of that as well when I was reading it. And then at one stage I thought, this is the one Inika was talking about, but I realised it was a different...
Sounds like it has some of the same kind of vibes. Yeah. Oh, cool. Oh, really great. Well, I had a few days off in the last week or so I did get a little bit of reading done. So I started with just a little short and sweet one. So I read a book called Whereabouts by Jhumpa Lahiri. And this is a brand new novel, 2021, and it's in the adult fiction collection, and it's also on Overdrive as well. Now, this is actually my first read of a book by Jhumpa Lahiri. I haven't read her short stories or her other novels, but it definitely won't be my last. I was really, really fascinated by her writing, and I'd love to read some more already. Now, Jhumpa Lahiri is a real citizen of the world. She was born to Bengali parents in London, and then the family moved to the States when she was around 3. And she studied many languages while she was growing up and in her university years. And she actually won a Pulitzer for her very first short story collection, which was called Interpreter of Melodies.
Which was amazing. That was fantastic.
Was it?
Yeah.
I
recommend that one.
Oh, well, this is right. And I understand that one and some of her further works after that, sort of both short stories, nonfiction, and a couple of novels as well, were kind of about the Indian experience, both in India, but also as second and third generation immigrants, I understand. A couple that I've seen on the shelves are The Namesake and The Lowlands, which was a shortlisted for the Man Booker a few years ago, maybe 2017-18, something like that. Anyway, I found out that she actually upped sticks after in the last few years. She's upped sticks and moved to Rome. And she had started studying, she'd visited Florence as a university student and absolutely fell in love with Italy and with Italian. So she started taking Italian lessons in New York. And then she decided that she actually wanted to move to Italy and totally immerse herself in the language and in the culture. So her whole family moved to Rome, and she now lives there permanently. And she declared that even though she was kind of like not fully fluent at that stage, she decided that she was going to write purely in Italian, and that any of her writing from now on would be in Italian and translated back into English.
Wow.
You're a pretty amazing woman.
Yes, what a gifted woman she must
and
be.
And that's a bold move, isn't it, when you're a writer who's already had acclaim writing in English, but then to decide that you're going to fully change your writing into another language and translate it back. Really, really fascinating.
Wow.
I did have a little look online to sort of see what, and her writing in Italian has also won awards. So she's obviously just one of these brilliant and talented women and writers. Now, this is another one of my little books, but with hidden depth. So it's only just over 150 pages, really, really short chapters. Some of them are just a page long. So this book covers a year of the unnamed narrator's life. It tracks her time spent in an unnamed city. I'm going to say it's Rome to me. It sounds like Rome, which is where she lives. And she is visiting places like the local coffee shop, the park down the road, an art gallery downtown, the supermarket, all the different places around and her area and just outside her city. Now, as she goes around, she's recording her kind of sensory impressions of those places and her internal experiences of being in there, those spaces, and also her interactions with strangers and acquaintances, family members who she bumps into or meets. She lives alone, and we hear how this is both a lonely experience but also liberating for her, depending on the day in the mood. She's often casting her mind back to her childhood and to the relationship that she had with her parents and to their relationship with each other, because they had quite a fractious relationship. And the older that she got, or this unnamed narrator got, the more fractious it became, and she got pulled into the mix as a bone of contention between her parents, with her father seeing her as more of a better companion or a better person to share himself with than her mother. So it was quite complex. Anyways, the year wears on, she finds herself getting kind of more aware of her own place in the city and her own sense of self. And she takes a train ride out to her mum, and this kind of leads to a resolution of where change needs to happen in both her personal and her professional life. So she kind of grows as a person and makes a big decision by the end of the book. Now, her writing's quite stylistically plain, but man, she has such skill in conveying so much in such really quite plain and stark language. It really reminded me of Rachel Cusk and the trilogy, the Outline Trilogy, I think it's called. Yeah, she's clearly a very deeply engaged observer of life and also of herself. She's, you know, very reflective. I'm really looking forward to reading more from her.
Yeah, I'm going to read this now that you've given it such a good review. It's interesting that you mention Rachel Cusk, because I've been reading Rachel's new book this week. But I'm just wondering if Jhumpa Lahiri might be more well-liked by the critics, perhaps, or well-received than Rachel Cusk. So the one I was just telling you about it earlier, it's called Second Place by Rachel Cusk. It's only just been published. And, of course, she's the Canadian-slash-British author, famous or perhaps infamous too for that Outline trilogy. Mm. And she's up sticks and she lives in Paris.
Oh, yes, that's right.
So now, this is Second Place. It's a first-person sort of testimony by and a character that you only know as M, who's a writer. M invites the celebrated painter, who is known as L, to stay in the annex of her home in the marshlands. So they say that the writer M is almost like Rachel Cusk herself, and the marshland home is very much like Rachel's British home that she apparently sold. And they even criticised her because it sold for a really big price. Is that her fault?
Is that not the common way nowadays?
Yes, that's right. It's almost like whatever she does, she can't win.
Can't catch a break, hey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, the writer M is kind of half in love with this painter L, and she's sort of desperate for his attention, and she just wants to be accepted by him, etc. And even though she's got a husband who's living there as well,
Okay.
And she's also got an adult daughter living on the property. So it's like this big, almost like a bohemian enclave of artists and writers that she's writing about. It speaks to a lot of privilege from the painter L that she's that she has invited to stay, because you almost worry at times that he's going to destroy her with the way he's sort of quite cruel in the way that he either ignores her or acts as though he's in love with her, etc. So now the book's had mixed reviews. I largely enjoyed it. But it's a really, really slow burn.
It's
sort of glacial, really. And the first thing that I noticed when I started reading the book, I was reading it in hard copy, was this use of a typeface that she uses, and it's called Optima.
Okay.
You might know what that is, but it's all I knew, even though I've got an untrained eye for it. It's a really unusual typeface to use in a book.
Okay.
And it's that sans serif, so it doesn't have the toppy, bottom, knee bits, you know, on the
letters.
Those bits. Yeah, that's sort of in the technical terms that we describe it. But I just sort of thought, this is weird. Maybe this is all the introduction that I'm still reading, you know, because it just looked different.
Well, especially with the slow burn element.
Yes, that's right. So this is the longest introduction I've ever read in my life. But curiously, the critics have said, you know, how that she can't catch a break. Mm. Her use of this particular typeface adds to an indefinable sense of threat in her novels. So they've sort of said it's like an aggression that she has, which I just think that's a bit, maybe she just likes that typeface. And as you were saying earlier, if she could get it past the editors and the publisher, if they said, look, it's unusual, but we'll print it.
We'll run with it, yeah.
Who's to criticise that? Yeah, it's very strange, isn't it? But anyway, it's a tale of sort of midlife malaise, midlife crises all round. And she's based it on a book written in about 1932, I think, about when D.H. Lawrence was invited by a socialite in New Mexico to stay. So D.H. and Frieda Lawrence stayed with this woman in Taos, New Mexico for 6 months or something. And I think it was also emotionally awful too. And so then this woman wrote a book about it. Mabel Dodge Lujan is the woman who wrote it in 1932. So, D.H. Lawrence apparently threatened to destroy her. So for some reason, Rachel Cusk has taken that experience and written this new novel.
Translated it over.
Yeah. Mm.
So, wow, what's the lesson of this tale?
Yes.
Beware of inviting artists to your...
I think it might be.
To your holiday home.
Yes. they may never leave. And B, they'll threaten to destroy you. So, but as I say, it's a slow burn. It probably won't be everyone's cup of tea, but I'm glad I've read it.
Yeah, nice. Well, this is probably a little bit different from that one. I absolutely chewed through a young adult novel, a teen novel, on my break. And I read it on Overdrive, but it's also available in hard copy. And this is an Eileen Merriman book, and I'm pretty sure I reviewed an Eileen Merriman book weeks ago, I think it was Silence of Snow.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, so she's writing, she writes primarily for teens, so this is the first one for teens that I've read of hers, and this is a 2020 novel called A Trio of Sophies. Now, this book is in a diary format, so we're reading the diary of the main character, 16-year-old Sophie Mack. Now, Sophie Mack is one of the trio of Sophies. She is the smartest Sophie of her three friends, but actually she longs to be the most beautiful Sophie, like Sophie A, her mate, or to be wealthy rather than kind of struggling along in a small flat with her single mum. Sophie T, her other friend, is very, very wealthy. Now, we find out from her diary entries that over the last summer holidays, she began an intense relationship with a very attractive man in his 20s who she met when she was out running one day. Now, he sort of comes on quite strong, and she sort of falls head over heels for him. He tells her that she's beautiful and that she's bright, and she lies and tells him that she's 19 and about to start uni rather than just going into maybe sixth or maybe seventh form. She's about 16 going on 17. Now, later on, she finds out that he's actually a secondary school teacher, and guess which school that he's starting at in the new year. Now, you would think that when he finds out this, that he would stop the relationship straight away. And initially he does, but then the relationship starts up again when the school year has carried on. The majority of this book actually counts backwards. So it starts at day 65 in her diary, and the entries are slowly revealing more and more about their relationship, while at the same time you're heading towards this fateful day zero, which is the day when one of the Sophies in that trio goes missing. So there's actually quite a lot going on in this book. It's super, super hooky, heaps to uncover and lots of reveals. So it's got a cross between the first love story but with a very dark kind of side. It's got mystery elements with lots of plot twists, and it's also the story of, female friendships being tested and put to the test by those kind of first informative partnering relationships. Mm. Yeah. This one is definitely not for younger teens, I have to say, because the main focus is a very intimate relationship between a 16-year-old student, so she is, technically legal, and her 25-year-old teacher, so nearly 10 years older. There's some fairly steamy but not explicit scenes, on beaches and in weekends, dirty weekends away in the batch, and in bedrooms as well. So it's something to be aware of there. And there's also elements of kind of abusive, manipulative relationships. The narrator's view on the relationship kind of complicates matters too, because it's sort of, she's veering between wishing that it had never happened and then wishing that it could keep going or go even further. So this is quite similar to that My Dark Vanessa for a younger audience. Having said those sort of little warnings there, I think older teens would really get a lot out of this book. I certainly really enjoyed it. I think it's also really worth reading if you're the parent of a teenager, because it would be a really great jumping off point for those conversations around what makes a healthy romantic relationship, what makes an unhealthy romantic relationship, and also how those can tie back to other, relationships with your family or with your good friends as well.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds as though it's going to be a really important book, because you're saying about My Dark Vanessa, which was just creepy, wasn't it?
Yes.
But I think as we of a certain age will read, though, because we're more experienced, we get the creeps really quickly. And whereas our daughters, perhaps who are teens, may go into something like that more in a more of an innocent frame of mind.
Yeah, and that's why it's definitely one to watch at this one, because this is from her perspective as a young person. Mm. With My Dark Vanessa, she's looking back on the relationship, but she still kind of has that that romantic, slightly romanticised view of what was actually disturbing and damaged relationship.
And even though she's starting to realise, she's horrified when she starts to realise how damaging and abusive that relationship was.
But she still can't quite let it go either. So, I think those two are a good pair to read together.
And it sounds as though there'd be, as you say, lots of conversation starters and teachable moments there.
Definitely, but at the same time, it's a great read. Yeah, really compelling. I couldn't put it down. I stayed up really late reading it just to finish it off over a night.
Yes. Oh, she's so good, Eileen Merriman, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to look that one up as well. Mm. Well, look, I think this seems to have gone really quickly, doesn't
it? We've had a lot of fun, haven't we?
Session, and we could have talked more. We've got about 30 seconds, so I'm not quite sure what we can do. We're going to continue this, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Well, I definitely have a huge stack of to-be-read books, so I'm really looking forward to coming back and talking about those next time. Heaps to share next time as well.
I think we probably could, we'll continue on from here when we're when we're on air next.
Sounds good.
We'll do that. So sorry that we didn't get through everything we wanted to today. We were overambitious. But look, thanks for tuning in today, listeners. Take care. Happy reading. And haere rā, ka kite anō.
By Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime on